On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Wayne State University medical researcher, Dr. Donald DeGracia, about his critical look at Western science and yogic knowledge.
Western culture itself is very focused on the external world, what the senses convey to the mind. And it just takes it all for granted because it has nothing to contrast it to. It builds the entire picture. And it misses the complete irony sitting in the center of the whole thing that it all only exists in the mind. Everything I'm perceiving right now as I sit here and talk, you're all only in my mind. It's all only in my mind, right? And so the West directed itself outward and the Indian Hindu culture directed itself inward. And that inward exploration led to yoga.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I have one of those shows that really made me appreciate how much I love doing Skeptico and bringing these great interviews to you. And the reason I enjoyed this show so much was because of our guest, Dr. Donald DeGracia, who is really so bright and yet is able to take his broad range of knowledge about so many different things and bring it down to a simplified level that really makes sense. And I have to say, I hope you enjoy this interview that we're going to do that's primarily on comparing and contrasting Western science and yogic science, I guess you will, and other ways we have of knowing from other traditions, which is a very interesting topic. But what you won't hear, because I cut it out because it was an after conversation thing, was about 20 or 30 minutes that he took to explain to me what his day job is, if you will, and his research into nonlinear dynamics and a new way of looking at medical research through that lens. But it reinforced for me what I already knew, which is that this guy has a depth of knowledge about a range of different topics that he brings to everything that he does. And I think that's always makes it much more exciting for me when I have an opportunity to really learn something. So I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did. Let's get right to it. Today we welcome Dr. Donald DeGracia to Skeptico. Dr. DeGracia is an associate professor of physiology at Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit, where his research on nonlinear dynamics of cell injury is so far over my head that I'm not even going to try and get into that. We'll just have to ask him directly. But Dr. DeGracia is also a brilliant writer and thinker on human consciousness. And that's the real reason I wanted to have him on the show. He's also written and talked a lot about altered states of consciousness, and in particular, the synthesis of and, well, I guess we'd have to say the critical examination of Western scientific thought and yogic and Hindu knowledge and wisdom. And he has a lot of very interesting ideas about the intersections and, I guess, non-intersections of those two. So without anything more of me going on, Dr. DeGracia, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks again so much for joining me.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Alex, for having me.
Well, great. You know, Don, your work was introduced to me by several listeners on Skeptico, who I really have to thank, Dr. John Brown, and then again by the publisher at Anomalous Press, who's publishing my book, Patrick Koiga, also suggested that you'd be a great guest. And everyone was right, because as I dug into your work, it was terrific. It's one of those, I was reading this book that I want everyone to check out if you're at all interested after this show. It's What is Science? How Yoga Helps Us Understand Science. It's one of those books that I started reading with the idea that I'm going to highlight some questions for the show, and I wound up highlighting practically the whole book. So I was like, wait a minute, I better just slow down here and ask some basic questions about this book. And let me just throw in, so much of your work is available for free. This book, you can buy a hard copy cover of it, but you can also get it as a free download from your really excellent blog as well, Plain Talk About This and Other Worlds, where this book that we're going to talk about a lot about first appeared as a 10-part blog series. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So let's slow down and go back to who you are, as you like to say, how you get your paycheck there at Wayne State University. Tell us a little bit about your day job, if you will.
Well, I'm a researcher in cerebral ischemia, which is stroke and cardiac arrest brain damage. And having listened to some of your podcasts before coming on, I was interested to hear that you're interested in like cardiac arrest and near-death experiences. That's a facet of the area I work in, although my work is very biological, and it studies the mechanisms of how the neurons die after a lack of blood flow.
We're going to talk about consciousness science and some of the ways, some of the dramatic ways that it kind of conflicts not only with common sense, but with other schools of thought. But I think it's interesting to kind of juxtapose that with your day job, your highly regarded, highly technically demanding day job of being in the School of Medicine doing research at Wayne State University. Does that ever strike you that you kind of live this double life there?
Well, you know, part of it has to do with the fact that growing up, I was a big comic book fan, right? So all superheroes have a secret identity.
I see.
But, you know, more importantly, I think, you know, this is hard to appreciate unless you actually have the experience. But, you know, the 1,000-hour idea, where you just keep doing something over and over and you get the experience. And that's what it has been doing science for 25 years, right? And in the lab every day doing this totally mainstream work, trying to figure out this issue of why did these neurons die after lack of blood flow. And, you know, over the whole period that I've been doing it, the one overwhelming lesson is that it doesn't work more often than it does. Way, way more often it doesn't work. I mean, probably 99% of the time I've been wrong. So, you know, science is a really difficult process. It's, you know, second guessing nature is very, very difficult. And, you know, having that direct experience of playing that game has conditioned my thinking very strongly.
You know, that might be an interesting launching off point, because I think it kind of brings to the fore this whole idea of science. What is science? How do we do science? And what are some other ways that people think about and do science? Because I love some of the things that you have to say in the book. And one of the most basic, but at the same time profound things, and it's obvious once someone points it out to you, but science means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And at a very simple level, you can go around the university there at Wayne State University and you can go ask a sociologist, what is science? And he says, oh, I do science. I'll tell you what I do over here. And then you could go over to the physics department. You go ask them, what is science? They go, oh, right here. Bring over here. I'll show you. And then you could go ask someone in the School of Medicine and they'd say something different. Yes. And so science means a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Yes, right? It is not a homogeneous phenomenon by any stretch of the imagination.
I guess what struck me and what I'm struggling with here is science gets bantied around so much, the idea of science and you do science and science versus religion and we should trust science. And we never stop to think about what we really mean when we say science. And I think you do a really nice job of breaking down what we do mean, what our history of science is. And then you introduce this idea of yogic thought and science.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's one of the things, especially when you start off with this idea that it means different things to different people. And the biggest demarcation there is people that actually do science versus people that are outside of science looking in and interpreting what they think is going on. And, you know, when you're on the inside, it's just like any other human activity. You have politics, you have the whole, it's a Gaussian distribution. You have a few really smart people and a whole bunch of people that are, you know, leaders and followers, basically. And, you know, it's not very much different from everyday life. And in my particular field, the stroke field, you know, it's not very successful. There are no therapies that can stop neuron death after stroke, you know, in spite of 40 years of research. So in a way, it's kind of the exact opposite of physics, where these guys just, you know, built the Large Hadron Collider and confirmed the Higgs particle that's been hypothesized for 40 years. I mean, what's the difference just in those two cases, right? Why is one so outstandingly successful and the other one just basically a miserable failure?
You touched on something there for a minute that you do a really nice job of talking about in the book. Can you explain what the demarcation problem is?
Right. Yeah. See, this all stems from – so there's a whole academic discipline called the philosophy of science. And it is attempting to understand and answer the question, what is science? And there's been a few kind of towering people that have contributed to the field. And one of them is Karl Popper. And he wrote in the 1920s and 30s. And there's a couple important ideas that Popper came up with. One of them is this idea of falsification, which is a very common idea that you find out, especially amongst the physics people, that when you invent a theory, the purpose of it is to not prove that it's true, but to prove that it's false. Because you can never definitively say that something is true, right? That's something that Hume identified, the philosopher David Hume, that this thing called his problem of induction, that you never know tomorrow if you'll observe a contrary case. And so Popper, taking that into account, came up with this idea that to be successful in our description of the world, what we want to do is to determine which ideas are false, because we can definitively prove something is false. We can never conclusively prove something is true. So that's one of the main things that Popper is known for. But he also invented this idea of the demarcation problem. How do you distinguish science from other activities that humans do? And the falsification criteria was his answer to that. So science is an approach to knowledge that seeks to prove ideas are false, period. It's an open-ended thing. It never ends.
And what you do nicely in the book is kind of take that a little bit further than Popper, or you kind of step back and you say, hey, isn't this demarcation problem really what we've been fighting over about science? It's been the little skirmish that's in the background that really is a much bigger deal. And that is, somebody comes along and says, well, that's science. And somebody else comes along and says, well, no, that's not science. And it's really, how do we measure what is science and what isn't science? And one of the ways we can do that is say, well, science affects the world, and we come up with these radical ideas that have these power and influence, and we make atomic bombs, and we make cell phones, and we make all these other things. And then somebody else comes along and says, yeah, but this guy did this fantastic movie, this piece of art, and it totally changed people's minds, and that changed the world. So maybe art and science, how would you draw the difference? Or politics, like you say, or religion has changed the world.
Exactly. If you notice in the book, I never actually explicitly draw that distinction, because I don't believe there is such a thing. I think science is a form of art, not any different than any other form of art that humans do. The type of science we have in our culture right now, at least. It has the properties that I talk about in the book. And the reason, you know, it's kind of, I guess, to back out a little bit, to give some sense of what I, you know, you asked, what am I trying to do in this? And, you know, I was thinking about how could I explain something like that? And, you know, the issue is you only know something by contrast to something else. It's just the way that our brain and our mind and our senses work. And so, you know, like for one a kind of obvious example, we walk around in the air all the time. Right. But we're always in that environment. And so it seems like nothing to us, even though we're like fish in water. Right. We're moving through a medium. We never experience the vacuum. Right. So the air is actually invisible to our awareness. And, you know, analogically, we have this science permeating our culture in the same way. And we just, what do we have to compare it to? Nothing. And so it's kind of invisible in a certain sense. And so, you know, as I've been learning the ideas of yoga, it's clear that they overlap substantially. And, you know, what I try to do in the book is show that in many respects, the yogic ideas are much grander, much broader in their scope and account for things that our Western sciences can't, taken in the very broadest historical sense, looking since the, you know, evolution of science from the days of Newton and Leibniz.
And if people are tempted to think that that sounds very New Agey or something like that, you really break it down in a very concrete way that's hard to dismiss and get past. And that contrast that you do, and you point out that there's these British Christians that come over to this continent of India, and they get there, and they have these certain ideas. And what you do is
compare and contrast this with the ideas that they encounter. And you say, hey, well, wait a minute. Here's what the people of the continent of India had that they didn't.
Exactly. You have to put yourself 300 years ago, 400 years ago. There were no cars. There was no electricity. People had candles. They drove in wooden ships across the ocean. The British obviously were militarily superior. And, you know, they had their Christian ideas that they had inherited from medieval Europe. They had their Renaissance ideas that they inherited from the Greeks and Romans.
Many of which we now know are wrong, right? So what are some of the ways that the Indian thought, the yogic thought, was really much further advanced?
Right. So consider that, you know, like I say in the book, the Christians believed the world was 6,000 years old. So it had been calculated. That was something from that era. And based on biblical, you know, logic of the Bible, I don't want to go into that story. But, you know, you go to the Indian culture, and here they are saying that the universe is 300 trillion years old. Right. I mean, it's just the British mind could not understand that at the time. And that's just one example, right? They also believed that the universe began in this highly condensed state that they called the Brahmanda, right? The egg that began the universe. And that idea didn't become anything in the West until the 1930s, and we call it the Big Bang today, right? And if you look at the ideas, they're very, very similar.
And if we go over to mathematics, as you do, you point out, hey, take zero and take infinity, two ideas that we really can't do any kind of math other than kind of Roman numeral stuff without.
And they had these ideas. They were integral part of their, you know, it's hard to refer to Hindu ideas as religious. Right? That's a mistake we make in the West. It's not a religion. It's closer to Hinduism itself is closer to what we think of as philosophy, but yoga is much closer to what we think of as science, because yoga is methods and procedures, just like science is. And Hinduism as a whole is a bunch of different philosophical viewpoints. And yeah, and so, you know, how could the, again, I don't know what else to say. I mean, who's the barbarian in this picture, right? These people that think the universe is 6,000 years old and have these very primitive notions about the nature of reality, and then the Hindus who have these just unbelievably sophisticated ideas that the British can't even understand. You know, one of the main point I really try to make in the book is this idea of the gunas, which is just a central idea. The more I've come to understand Hindu and yogic thought, the more I've come to see that, and not only that, but the more I've come to understand Western science and where it's going. This idea of the gunas, it's thousands and thousands of years old. By the time Patanjali codified it in the Yoga Sutras, it was already an ancient idea. And, you know, the idea of gunas is the idea that everything that we perceive is just patterns of movement. There is no substance, period. Reality, the stuff that's probably the biggest contrast between the Hindu mind and the Western mind, is that the Western mind believes in reality, but the Hindu doesn't. What we call reality, the solid real world, rocks, the stars, the planet, our bodies, the Hindu just sees as something akin to the wind. It's a pattern of movement, and that's it. It just moves. It flows like a river. It's a flowing, a movement. It's not made of anything. It's just a pattern of movement.
And so let's say we wanted to look at that question in a serious way, right? Because we don't. We just dismiss that and we say, oh my gosh, that's so ridiculous. Let's just move on. But let's say we really wanted to break that down in the way that you're breaking it down here and say, how would we really logically determine which worldview maybe stands up to our experience, to our shared experience, to logic? And I think that immediately gets us into this idea of consciousness, which you talk so much about and do so much work in. And that is, so let's break it down and talk about the yogic understanding of consciousness.
So this idea you asked, you know, the Hindu worldview versus the Western worldview with respect to this idea of the gunas and that everything is just patterns of movement. Well, I mean, that's what Einstein is famous for, is just describing that energy, matter is energy. Up to Einstein, they had been a dualism. They were seen as two opposite, a dichotomy, but then he showed they were interconvertible. And that changed the world, right? And so that was the beginning of the West coming to appreciate this ancient Hindu idea. And, you know, it has only progressed further. So, you know.
Yeah, but hold on, because, Don, I mean, it has and it hasn't, right? I mean, that's one of the great paradoxes of the time that we live in, is we can say, and then Einstein came along and he changed the world. But no, he didn't change the world in a way. I mean, the predominant paradigm of science is still this kind of materialistic, you are a biological robot, you are your brain kind of thing.
Well, and this brings us back to science is different things to different people. So, you know, the movers and shakers that are using these ideas are the ones that gave us the computers that are letting us communicate right now, that give us the cell phones. In other words, physicists and engineers that utilize these ideas, GPS, that utilize these ideas in a practical fashion. And, you know, I brought up the question earlier, why have those guys been so successful? And, for example, a lot of biomedical stuff that I'm, you know, that my own work is directly involved in has not been successful. It's because we don't use the same logic those guys use, right? So there is, I don't want to use the word demarcation, but it is a demarcation. That's the heterogeneity of science. It is not a constant thing. Whole fields use completely different methodologies, and they're just less successful than other fields that use more successful methodologies. So anyway, you're correct. I agree with you that the ideas have been very slow to diffuse throughout the general culture, right? But they are there, and they're what underlie all this technological revolution that has, you know, characterized the 20th century.
You know, I see that, and I don't want to get too far off into this, but I see that, but I see also the strong resistance to it still in every corner of science that you look. I mean, you know, we want to kind of pretend that the quantum physicists are way out on the edge, but they're not. Only some of them are. Some of them are willing to take it to the next level, and the other are just doing the shut up and calculate thing, which is what so much of science does when they encounter this stuff that doesn't fit inside their paradigm. They're like, shut up and calculate, churn out the technology.
That's a very serious issue too. And I mean, that falls squarely in the philosophy of science. And why would that thing come to pass? And in a way, that's almost like an immune response of our society and our culture,
right,
to the implications of what these ideas imply, right? So you have people like Feynman. On my blog, I wrote an article about my ambivalent feelings towards Feynman,
because right,
obviously the man was a genius. He revolutionized quantum mechanics. But if you listen to him talk philosophically, I apologize to all Feynman fans, but he sounds like a retard.
Right.
He didn't study it. He doesn't know it. He has no sophistication or subtlety at that level of thinking. And these are the people. So it's like we've given kids, not guns, atom bombs. Right. We've given a bunch of kids atom bombs, and they have this tremendous power that they manipulate. And, you know, in my mind, the image of Atlantis comes to mind, right? The whole myth of Atlantis. That's what this all seems like it's converging towards sometimes when I think about it. Mm-hmm. But and I agree. I don't want to go off on that too much. That could be a whole topic in and of itself. But so to, you know, return back to your question about consciousness and Indian thought. Should we go back to that then?
Let's do that. But let's also tie it back into what we're just talking about, because as I was reading in What is Science, your book, I saw so many parallels between that and the state we are in currently with our understanding of consciousness and the absurdity of what we assert about consciousness in Western thought, in Western science. And even, you know, again, not to put down anybody, but even somebody like David Chalmers, who's wonderfully, you know, revolutionized consciousness research and this hard problem. But then you just read it and you go, what is all this hand-wringing about what is obvious? And that is that consciousness is obviously not just brain function. It's obviously more than that. Why do we stumble on such basic ideas in the same way that I think, you know, we look at the British Christians, they're going, hey, the world is 6,000 years old. Don't tell me any different. It was an absurd idea, I think, even for their scientists at the time, yet it was something that we cling to. And I kind of get that same feeling about consciousness. I mean, that we're just clinging to just an obviously absurd idea.
So isn't David Chalmers the bat guy?
Yeah, I think it is. It's
yeah. Did you get my little graphic, Batman Spanking Science?
Oh, I didn't see that in the book.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's this idea of having something to contrast to, and if you don't, it's invisible, right? So we, you know, the West has always been characterized by just being outwardly directed, you know, completely sensory based. It, the understanding of mental events, and I say this being well aware of the 2,000 years of Western philosophy, you know, I mean, Plato actually said the right things, and people just didn't get what he was saying or something, you know. I mean, it's something about the Western tradition that likes to rule and have power and control the world that seems to be outside of the body. And that is what has, you know, led to this very large dichotomy. And so, you know, Western culture itself is very focused on the external world, what the senses convey to the mind. And it just takes it all for granted because it has nothing to contrast it to. It builds the entire picture. And it misses the complete irony sitting in the center of the whole thing that it all only exists in the mind, right? The everything I'm perceiving right now as I sit here and talk, you're all only in my mind. It's all only in my mind, right? And so, you know, there's like solipsism. That was like one Western approach to it, that, oh, it's only all in your mind. And then that's obviously absurd because the guy comes up and punches you in the face, right? And so the West has always had a superficial approach to this, you know? And I cited Jay Lacani in my book in a talk he gives that I thought was very insightful, talking about the demographics of India, right? He says it in just one little line in a kind of blow-off way. He says, I don't know what it was. It was the weather or something, but we went inward, right? And it was the climate they had. They were rich. They had a bountiful land. They didn't have to struggle for existence like people in Europe did, where it was cold and they had to farm and bad land and stuff. In India, more stuff died just naturally than what grew in Europe, right? And then they had all this excess. And so the land was so rich and so bountiful that the people there could have the leisure to just sit and develop yoga, right? And so what they did is, instead of being preoccupied with the external world, again, citing Jay's ideas, because he says it very clearly, that they just said, well, what is it that allows me to perceive the external world in the first place? What is this external world that, like, is in my mind? What is this? What is my mind? How does all this stuff work? How does this all fit together? And they literally went in a different direction than the West. The West directed itself outward, and the Indian Hindu culture directed itself inward. And that inward exploration led to yoga.
It led to yoga, and it also led to this interesting kind of paradox that you arrive at in the book about hanging in the middle. We have the external world, which suggests to us over and over again that that is a reality. We have our purely internal world that we get some glimpses of as a reality. And where Right. we wind up in is trying to keep a foot in both these worlds, and we wind up hanging in the middle. But what is that all about?
Well, that's kind of my tongue-in-cheek, cynical, irreverent characterization of Western philosophy, right? Because, I mean, you can look at, since the rise of modern times in the 1600s, you know, we've had materialism and we have had idealism. One of the things I do in the book in a kind of comical way is paint that as a war. And in a way it is. It's an intellectual war that is constantly waged. And in certain eras of history, one side gains dominance over the other. We happen to live in an idealistic time right now, right? That's what postmodern is. Everything's in our mind. We make it all up. And even though average people don't really understand it, it's what drives politics. Go look at the philosophy behind the neocons, right? It's all perception. That's why media and, you know, politicians can just lie so easily now, because they're conditioned to believe that it's just what people believe. That's what makes reality. That's an idealistic viewpoint that just sees everything in the mind. And so, you know, the East has, obviously, we're aware that there's an external world and we have an internal world of mental states. And like I say in the book, you know, the world itself presents resistance to our thoughts, right? We think, but the world presents resistance to our thoughts. And mm-hmm. when you let that resistive aspect gain dominance, that's materialism. Then you come to the conclusion that the world somehow creates our mind. Or, you know, if you follow the path that, you know, George Berkeley started back in the time of Newton, it's all in our mind to begin with. Our mind is what creates the world we live in. right? Everything, our most humans' entire world is not the natural world at all. We live in a human-created world. Our house, the movies we watch, the stores we shop in. Well, you know, people don't even know how to grow food, right? So everything that most people experience is the human-created world. It's all just in the mind. It's George Berkeley writ large across our lives. And so, you know, you look at the West and it's kind of stuck in a way in this dualism, this oscillation back and forth between these two viewpoints. And, you know, again, I mean, I grew up in this society too. It's very dissatisfying. It makes people very unhappy. People in our culture are not happy. There's not like any kind of harmony that underlies this tension that kind of is at the center of our culture. And so like anybody else, probably like you, you know, you start to explore and try to figure out what the hell's going on in the world. And through the different avenues of my explorations, I come across Hinduism and to learn their ideas and see the contrast, right? And that's really a lot of what this book is attempting to express, is to be like, holy wow, you know, it's amazing that you can have a viewpoint where all of this comes into harmony, is what it amounts to. And it's not New Agey at all. In fact, it's highly consistent with our modern sciences.
Well, it's consistent up to a point, isn't it? I mean, it's consistent if you look at things in a certain
way. Yeah, right. You're right. I got to be careful. So, you know, in the book, I define science as that which leads to the release of power in the universe, right? And so anything that doesn't do that, I don't consider science, which includes, you know, in a way, the stuff I do at work even, you know.
Don, talk about that for a minute, because you have some interesting ideas about power and about thought is power, knowledge is power. And at the surface, I love the way you break it down, because it becomes self-evident when you talk about it. Equals MC squared. Knowledge is power. You have that knowledge. You operationalize it with technology. You wind up with power. Again, you have a demarcation problem. Well, where was the power? Where was the science? Was it in the idea? Well, ideas. You know, go ahead.
Yeah, the whole idea stems from my understanding of the Hindu concepts. And again, reading the yoga, right? I mean, like I say in the book, we obviously haven't talked about this at this point, but, you know, I've had experiences with altered states of consciousness. They exist. They're real. People that know about it have a wide variety of opinions about it, but you know, that's something, that's a whole different discussion in itself. But that's the basis of yoga, is those types of experiences. And you know, so having had them, I take what they say seriously, is what it amounts to. And in their teachings, like I talk about in the book, the basic principle of existence they call the Shiva Shakti Tattva, right? And it's this separation that there's this idea of Brahman, of infinity, this like perfectly harmonious integration of everythingness. I mean, it's the concept is awe-inspiring if you really understand what it means. And within this awe-inspiring wholeness of existence, or whatever, you know, I don't want to go off on what Brahman, you know, how to characterize Brahman, but there's this process that occurs that is this separation that occurs in Brahman that is the genesis of what we call reality in the West, you know, of the manifested existence. And Shiva is consciousness and Shakti is power. And they are two poles of the same thing, right? It's this thing that artificially separates within itself. And so they're indelibly interrelated from the genesis of the universe, according to Hindu thought. And so, you know, I mean, to me, it's just a really incredible idea, because it explains why we can have thoughts and you know, why the mere thought equals MC squared can blow up a city. Right? It's not a mere thought. Obviously, there's some connection. There's some intimate connection. And the Hindu ideas explain this connection. It's very convoluted, very contorted. You know, the Shiva Shakti Tattva is very far from our personal realities, but there's a direct connection. And
well, let's talk about that connection a little bit, because I think what you do a nice job of in the book is talk about a little point that you made right at the beginning, which is that your launching off point for this exploration of yogic thought is some of the stuff that we just talked about, which is, hey, if they're right about this, and I can feel confident they're right about this because everything I know tells me, you know, that this is true, and this is, and that this understanding of consciousness, let's say, is more accurate than the Western idea. As you liken it to your drilling yourself with the 10,000 hours in biology or in chemistry, where you just build on what you know, and then at some point you gain confidence that even what you don't know, but you know is out there, will be revealed to you and will be true because everything you've learned up to this point has been true. So you start with biology 101, and then you go to 201 and 301, and you go, you know, I'm probably going to agree with what they have in biology 401. And you take a similar path with yoga, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and even that, you know, that approach that I have personally in science came from me just playing music. Right. As a teenager, I started playing guitar, and I didn't know how to play guitar, but there were other people around me that played guitar. I could see them play guitar. And through that process, I learned that if you practice, you get better. Right. And so by the time I went to college and decided I wanted to be a scientist, I already knew that trick. And so, you know, the problem with the altered states of consciousness, though, is you can't see anybody doing it. Right. So unless you have some initial experiences yourself, then, you know, it's not going to make any sense at all. You have no basis whatsoever to apply the practice logic to altered states of consciousness. But whatever my genetic makeup or my experience that I've had, I had these things spontaneously as a child, you know. And eventually as I got older and read about things and learned to understand these experiences as altered states of consciousness, and then, you know, I kept building on it, and I'm at a certain level of proficiency. You know, the angle that I've came into this through is what is called lucid dreaming or astral projection, but it's still a very definite altered state of consciousness. And it turns out that the ability to do that technique is what the yogis call pratyahara. The two techniques are almost identical. It's just the end to which they're applied is vastly different. And so, yeah, that's really the concrete anchor I have that allows me to say, okay, yeah, I actually know how to do pratyahara, and I've done it, and I just have never applied it the way the yogis do it. And then they describe what happens, you know, you following their methodology, it's just very logical that what they're describing is the way that it would unfold.
And let's tell people, because you've written a very practical, matter-of-fact book, and again, it's available as a free download, called Do OBE, as in Do Out-of-Body Experience, where you lay out and talk about not only your experiences, but kind of a step-by-step approach for how someone can gain success with lucid dreaming and with astral projection, out-of-body experience. And then you also mix that with some philosophical ideas and thoughts about that, one of which I think I wanted to bring up now because it was, again, just a small point, but it was a real shift for me when you talk about even the term altered state of consciousness is somewhat of a misnomer that takes us in the wrong direction, because it's an alternative state of consciousness. It's a different state of consciousness with different rules and different that has a whole different way of understanding things. And we always want to pull it back and go, well, what does that mean from our perspective? And maybe that's the wrong way of looking at it. Do you want to expound on that?
Well, I mean, it's like, how can I explain it? You know, soccer is not popular in America, right? But it's very popular around the rest of the world, you know, and they call it football. It's just what their cultures do. People grow up with the expectation. They train. Obviously, we have soccer here, but, you know, it's a crude analogy. But the idea is that we live in a culture that doesn't cultivate these experiences. We have the spontaneous manifestations of them. We call them dreaming.
Right.
But we don't understand it. I mean, the deepest
As you point out, we don't really have a very good language for it.
Exactly. I was just going to say the best we have is Carl Jung. And who reads him anymore? Right. And he was quite, you know, obscure in his own way. I mean, the thing about the yogic information and their teachings is it's just very, like, you know, simple and black and white what they're saying. It's not obscure. It's not like highly intellectual. It's designed for anybody that's ready to learn that stuff, it's just right there for you to learn it. You know, there's kind of certain prerequisites, but I think that's the really important point to recognize about this idea of altered states of consciousness is we grow up in a culture that just simply doesn't cultivate them and has no basis to understand them. And again, it's this issue of contrast. You look at the Hindu thinking where altered states of consciousness are revered, right? It's like the core thing in their culture to do yoga. It's part of their culture, right? There's the whole idea of, you know, being the child and being the householder and then being the responsible social member. And then at the end of your life, you go out in the forest and you meditate in preparation for dying, right? It's literally a part of their culture.
Right.
And so it's integrated. It's taken seriously. There's a very rich interpretation that surrounds it. And, you know, in comparison, we're literally blind on those levels. And so, yeah, you know, we can call them altered states of consciousness. They are. They're different than the one that we're in right now. But they have a very nice categorization of how these things work, how they're related. They have very distinct methods of how to get yourself from one to the other and what the implications of it all are.
And you've also taken that in another controversial direction, but a direction that you have to go in for anyone who's at all interested in this, and that is the contrast comparison of the use of psychedelics and altered states of consciousness. What were some of your thinking in doing that, and what was some of the things that you found out in exploring those connections?
Well, that's, you know, it's controversial again. But, you know, one of the interesting things back when the internet first started out, and somehow I got Charles Tart's email, right? So this was probably 1993 or something, 94. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to email this guy, right? Because I read his book, Altered States. It influenced me like it influenced so many other people. I'm thinking, if there's one question I could ask Charles Tart, what would it be? And so I wrote him and I asked him just one question. Why were psychedelic drugs made illegal? And he wrote me back and he said, because it allows people to think for themselves and they don't need the system anymore. And so, you know, I thought that was really, really interesting. And it's true, too. You know, it does, experimenting with those chemicals does something to your mind. And, you know, I've got a whole website about this, the link between what in Tantra yoga is called Kundalini awakening and the effects of psychedelic inebriation. And, you know, because in here in the West, we have like such primitive ideas about the nature of the mind and consciousness, the whole idea of what the effect of psychedelics are is just completely over our head. And, you know, it's interesting if you go back and read the literature from the 50s and 60s, there was some really serious, really good stuff going on. And people were starting to get a handle on it, and it was moving things in a direction. And you know, that's when, like, the Beatles went to India and started learning yoga, right? There's obviously a connection there. But the whole thing got, like, wiped out, right? The powers that be in the Western world just, like, stomped that fire out before it got out of control. And so here we are, you know, and now you see it's kind of coming back a little bit. There's the work that's been done with DMT. I can't think of the fellow's name off the top of my head, but Strassman.
Yep.
Strassman, right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his stuff's now all available on the internet, and he got some funding and did that work with DMT. And it's interesting to look at because it's exactly the same as the way the psychedelic literature went. It just immediately blows open the Western worldview. All right, those people, the you can see the video. It's up on YouTube, I believe.
Right.
You know, yeah, the interviews with the people that had these experiences. So, you know.
Well, there's also the interviews up there from the 1960s when they first were doing LSD experiments, and they did them with these. They're great videos because there's these very straight-looking, you know, 1950s guys with the button-up shirts and the ties just tripping and talking about these amazing experiences and the expansion of consciousness. They talk about these guys are engineers, and they talk about just these breakthroughs that they had in understanding of problems and stuff like that.
Right.
So all
well,
that's...
Know, I one of my good friends has this idea that... the psychedelic drugs came on the scene shortly after the atomic bomb was invented, and that it was somehow God's will that they both appear at the same time, right? Because they, like, totally counterbalance each other out, and they're of the same magnitude.
Well, you know, the other thing I think is interesting when you're talking about Tartt's response to your question, it's in the West, and particularly in the United States, we think of ourselves as being so freedom. And yet, you know, if you are not free to control your consciousness or manipulate your consciousness in any way you see, I mean, isn't that the core fundamental freedom that you could ever have? Is, hey, I am free to have my consciousness and manipulate it any way I want. And yet,
I gave my 2 cents worth about freedom in the book. I mean, I'm so steeped in yogic thought now that the idea makes no sense to me whatsoever. It literally makes no sense. I mean, we're in a world of relative existence where everything conditions everything else, and there's absolutely no freedom. I mean, I'm a highly deterministic person, actually. It's very, very complex. It's extraordinarily complex. And these psychedelic experiences open you up to the subtle complexities involved in it. But ultimately, this idea of freedom is just another ghost in our mind that it's like a carrot that draws people forward into experience.
Yeah, we just have to be kind of careful with that, I think, because it's at a level that is so beyond what we experience on a day-to-day basis, what we experience even in these extended consciousness realms that people achieve. That, I mean, if we're really going to look at it from a sociological standpoint or from an anthropological standpoint, we say there's a lot of ground, there's a lot of territory to traverse before we get to that ultimate determinism where there's just this kind of unified consciousness that's all going up. I mean, we have afterlife experiences, we have past lives, we have a lot of other stuff that we haven't processed before we get to that kind of ultimate. You know what I mean?
I agree. It would be a whole discussion about that. I don't want to go into that. It would definitely be a whole discussion. But yeah, it's very complex. That's why I added that in there.
Yeah. You know where I thought we might end? Because you do have such a unique perspective, and you've given you're at a vantage point that is unique too, in terms of you're deeply knowledgeable about science, but then you also have this broader view of where things might be heading from a consciousness perspective. I was wondering, what are your thoughts on parapsychology and kind of this Western approach to kind of pound it into this deeper understanding of consciousness? And I want to twist it around and say, is there a way that they can do that along the lines that they've been heading? Because you hinted at, you know, you got to take a different path, you know, and that some science is able to make that leap over and say, you know, forget all that, you know, we're going to take a quantum view of things, and they leap forward, and others are stagnant and stay with this kind of very materialistic, the world is out there and I'm in here and I have to measure it out there. Can parapsychology succeed with that kind of materialistic or at least dualistic kind of view of things? And if they can, how would they do it? How would you do Ganzfeld experiments? How would you do the experiments at the old Pear Lab at Princeton? How can they find this?
Yeah, my short answer is no. It's a fantasy. It's not going to work. Yeah, I have another free online book, if I can, you know, blow the horn on that. It's called Beyond the Physical. And Beyond the Physical, one of the chapters, it's a very wordy book. I wrote it when I was much younger, and it rambles on and on. But it's got a lot of interesting things in it. One of them, there's a discussion about that exact issue. And the starting point is, how can you talk about a quote-unquote anomalous phenomena when we don't even know how our own mind works, right? How is it that I actually understand you? What is it that I'm understanding? What is that process? How do we communicate, right? What does it mean for me to see the world? What are colors, right? The qualia problem. We don't even know how to solve the qualia problem. And you're going to go trying to do that stuff? I mean, talk about putting the cart before the horse, right? And so that's the angle that I've come at this at. And so to me, and the kind of the a broader way to context to have this in is something that you hear mystical people say often, is that the most awe-inspiring mysteries are the most common mundane things in our everyday lives. And, you know, our very act of being aware of the world, the thing that we do every day when we get up, we have no idea how that works. Mm-hmm. We totally take it for granted and we just go doing it. We're completely instinctive about it. We're no different than the way an animal is, or like a a spider building a web. The way a spider just mindlessly builds a web, we just mindlessly go around the world conscious of it. Right? So how does that even happen? Let's deal with that first. And then, you know, these other things, what'll happen is they'll just evaporate. Okay? Once you start to answer these questions, like from the angle I'm suggesting, is that you're going to be led into yoga, which will very systematically walk you into the other worlds. The other worlds exist, period. If you don't believe them, like I say in the book, if you don't believe them, go do retail sales or go work in a factory. You have no right being in this realm, right? If you want to pretend you're an intellectual, you need to be ready to deal with this stuff. And these things are real. And, you know, just because we're in a barbaric culture doesn't mean every human that's ever existed shares this barbarity. You can go learn this stuff and experience it for yourself and see. And it's very complicated. I mean, it's not trivial, right? This practice mentality is very, very important. You have to approach this stuff like you would, you know, seriously, like you would learning a musical instrument or learning mathematics or anything, right? It's not a joke at all. And so there's this kind of weird glibness that surrounds it. And you got to like just be prepared that you can't even begin to approach it that way. And, you know, and then when you bring it back to parapsychology, I mean, there's always an ambivalence that I feel towards these things because, you know, there's some degree of sincerity to these people that undertake these efforts. But mm-hmm. then, you know, it's like the principle of the lever. You want to put your effort where you're going to get the best return. And taking the methods of statistics that, you know, Fisher invented and trying to like quantify statistical events is not the best place to put the lever by a long shot. I told you my opinion of where to put the lever. Let's figure out what the mind and consciousness are in the first place, how they link to the brain and the body. Once you start to go down that path, then you're going to like naturally go into these other so-called anomalous areas and see that they're actually very natural. They're not anomalous at all. They're very natural. And so, you know, I've read through the parapsychology literature, and it basically has the same problem that my field has, this reliance on statistics in an inappropriate way. You know, that's really the big difference. I kind of alluded to this earlier, like why are physicists successful but biomedicine is not, right? There's no cures for cancer. There's no cures for heart attack or, you know, cardiac arrest, stroke, none of that. Right, you can't stop those processes once they've wrecked their damage, and it has to do with the mindset, right? So it's a statistical mindset. That's what a clinical trial is a statistical design. It doesn't try to understand the mechanisms. See, physics, chemistry, they're all about mechanism. They have a model, a picture in their mind, and this is what I talk about in the book, about we create in our mind a dynamical pattern that matches the pattern in reality. That dynamical pattern in our mind is the model, right? And you use math that you can solve that tells you how the thing changes in time. That's the dynamics. It works. That's this process that I'm describing in What is Science, of like we can somehow tap power through these methods.
Isn't that really the problem too? It works, right? So we try and take these ideas that you're talking about and we try and overlay them with our culture. You called it a barbaric culture, and I think that's probably accurate. Consumerism, materialism are so ingrained in our culture, and yet they work to a certain extent. They work. My iPhone works. My Skype here works. My lifestyle in the West, which is so far superior to anyone else in the world, basically works. So how do we resolve that as well?
Yeah, see, then it gets very complicated. You know, what it does is it like this is the stuff you learn when you start to really seriously study yoga, is that it very quickly becomes personal, right? Like I throughout What is Science, I cite a lot from a fellow, Swami Krishnananda, who I had just discovered like a year ago, and he's brilliant. And right away, he says that, you know, it opens you up. Studying yoga opens you up to true knowledge, right? And true knowledge is knowledge about yourself. That's how you get to the inner world, is by going through the barriers that you call yourself, your personality. And so it does start to turn inwards, and you start to learn what it means to turn inwards. And when you turn inwards, you're obviously focusing your consciousness in that direction and not outwards. And it's a really weird logic. I mean, to kind of summarize it in a broad way to put it in a context, the idea is if you really want to understand the world outside of you, you have to go to the very center of yourself, because there everything converges, right? And then if you use your senses to look at the external world, you get this like I describe in the book. You're just bouncing off the surface of things and you never see their essence, right? This idea that Kant had of the thing in itself, it seems like a fantasy, because you're never going to get it by using your senses to interact with the outer world. But if you go inside, see, everything converges at the center. And by following these methods, you can go into the center where you can touch anything in all of infinity. I mean, that's why yoga has the form it does. That's why the yogi doesn't care about the external world at all, because he knows it's futile. It's like trying to grab sand or grab the wind. You're not going to succeed at all. It's doomed to fail from the start. They know that from the start, and so they don't even waste time on that level of effort.
That's a hard sell, though.
Well, yeah, it is.
It's a hard sell even personally, and I've had a personal interest in yoga for 25 years. I wish I would have read your books a long time ago. I could have saved myself a lot of steps along the way.
And I don't want to sell anybody. I'm not trying to sell anyone.
No, I'm not suggesting you are. But my point is that we can't underestimate the extent to which we are enmeshed in that outer world, and more every day. And it can come across as kind of glib to talk about the yogi who realizes that the outer world is meaningless and go within and it's all there. It's like, well, wait a minute. That's not how I lived my day to day. That's not how I felt when I sent my kids off to school for the first day of school. It isn't relatable to my life in my questions of who am I? How do I get here? What do I do?
And you notice that I'm very kind of low-key in what is science on that front, right? Because just for exactly the reasons we're talking, it's very hard to try to express this stuff into words and to express it so it's meaningful to other people. I mean, it really is a person's personal journey to come to these insights. Because, you know, the truth is, for a Western person to take an interest in yoga, you have to have some degree of world weariness. I don't know how else to say it. You have to just look at all this. And, you know, how much fun can you have? How much glamour? How much of this titillating excitement that the Western cultures provide? How, you know, if you're some power mad person, you know, I mean, it's, all of these things are not too different from any kind of addiction, right? They just keep compounding, getting bigger, bigger. Where does it stop? And you realize it doesn't stop. It's limited by our form, but it potentially could just go on to infinity, right? And at some point, people have some experience along these lines where they just realize that, like, there's got to be a totally, like, it's not working. And so you've got to go some other way. You know, in my case, it actually has come about through just being an intellectual, through studying ideas and contemplating all these different meanings and realizing that, like, just holding, you know, it's kind of a very simple insight. By just holding an idea in my mind and thinking that it means anything other than I'm holding an idea in my mind, that's what I realized, right? I can't hold an idea in my mind and believe it's anything other than that now. That's where my head is at. Like, I can't think the world is this or the world is that or I am this or consciousness is that or whatever. It's just an idea in my mind. I can't recreate my existence in my mind. I can't recreate existence in ideas.
You can't step back into the illusion of...
Well, it's that, well, you know, I experience ideas as part of my experience. And what I experience is experience. I live. I'm alive. I have all these things that I go through day in and day out like you and everybody else. And, you know, and I think about certain things about it, but I don't believe anything I think about it because I don't know. I really just don't know. And so I keep studying and trying to learn and, you know, and that's kind of what's led me into this yoga stuff is trying to, you know, continue to pursue that because, like, you know, I have one statement in the book, just one sentence that, you know, if you don't understand, like, what Kant was saying about his whole idea of transcendental idealism, that what we perceive is in our minds and that we don't have access to the essence of the things that we're perceiving through our minds. That's kind of the basis of what I'm getting at here. And
there's more.
Well, you know, you exist. You're a real thing. right? You have some essence. I only see a superficial surface of it, right? I get certain cues, clues, stimuli. It builds a certain idea in my mind. What I know is that idea in my mind. I don't know your essence at all, right? I just know the kind of artifacts of what your essence leaves in my mind. That's what I know. And so what are you really? How would I get at that question? Right? There's, what am I going to do? Cut you open and dissect you? Weigh your brain? What? How do you get at that question? Mm-hmm. See, and that's the weird thing when you study yoga. It's like, no, you go inside yourself all the way to the center, and not only are you there, but everything else in infinity is there. That's the carrot they hold out in yoga. I mean, it's completely fantastic and unbelievable from a Western viewpoint. Right. And the only reason I can take it seriously is I've gone through large swaths of the Western viewpoint, and it all looks like the Wizard of Oz to me. I pulled back the curtain. Right. It's just this little shriveled man. There's not anything to it. It's all glamour. It's all hypnotism. And when you see through that, there's not really much there.
But the yogic tradition isn't perfect either. I mean, that's the other paradox, is we can look at the culture, we can look at the tradition, we can look at some of the great giants in it that have been exposed and is having some of the same human frailties that we all fall victim of. And that's not just a recent phenomena. That goes back for long, long periods of time. And it raises the same kind of questions. The other paradox I see that I can't overcome with the whole non-dual community, including a lot of the yogic people, is this desperation to achieve something along those lines. It's like, well, wait a minute. I mean, how would that even make any sense? You know, the old yogic thing is, you know, you must want enlightenment like a drowning man wants air. Well, why? I mean, isn't that kind of contradictory to the whole idea? Why would you want anything, including enlightenment? I mean, the paradoxes don't stop. And Western thought, I think the Western yogic tradition has brought a lot of good insights and has held the mirror up in some ways to the yogic traditions and said, hey, look at your own bullshit here, you know?
Yeah, that's a very cool point of view. I agree with that 100%. And that's part of why I'm always like in this synthetic mode. Let's mix Western and Eastern thinking. We both have good things to offer, and we both have a bunch of crap, too. And the good things that one has to offer helps to illuminate the crap that the other one has to offer. And I agree, too. I don't want to glorify Indian thought. I mean, you know, whatever I might say about freedom and liberty, at least we have that type of a society over here, right? And we don't have a caste system. Right. And I'm not knocking the caste system. It has a logic to it that is very compelling, right? But even India itself, as a modern secular state, has made the caste system illegal, right? It's part of their constitution over there. It's illegal.
Well, it winds up looking like a lot of our religious traditions that we might be able to trace back to some greater wisdom, but it's so contorted at this point that it has the absolute opposite effect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, one of the chapter titles in What is Science is The World is a Network of Unintelligible Relationships, right? Mm-hmm. That's a Swami Krishnananda quote. And that's kind of what we're sitting here telling each other. You know, it is. And what can you do? You sit back and what stance do you take towards it? I don't know. I'm not going to tell anybody what to do. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes I'm amused by it. Sometimes it freaks me out. All I can figure is that, like, it's just, you know, there's this outer one way that the yogis teach it is that the surface of life, this outer rim that we're experiencing of manifoldness, of differentness, is it's like this chaotic bubbling storm, you know, and it's just an eternal level of reality. You know, maybe it lasts for 300 trillion years and then it ceases for 300 trillion years and it comes back for 300 trillion, whatever. It's not like I'm going to see it. But, you know, that's about the level that I've come to look at it at.
Right.
It's just this level of this that we're experiencing. It is what it is. It's good. It's bad. It's just everything. You know, I mean, probably the best image that I can find that captures it is, I don't know if you've ever read the Bhagavad Gita.
Just parts.
Yeah, there's one of the passages where Arjuna asks Krishna to reveal his true self. And I swear to God, man, that is like one of my favorite things I've ever read, because it's literally everything. Literally good, bad, ugly, beautiful, just everything. And that was really that passage. I read that when I was in college, and I'm like, what? This is these people's idea of God? I mean, there was no God in the devil. It was just all God. Everything was God. There was no distinction, right? It was just everything, good, bad, ugly, all of it. And that was really the thing that hooked me into that way of thinking. I'm like, who are these people, and why do they think like this? And so, yeah, so I don't, you know, it's what it's done to me is I don't, there's no way in my human form that I'm going to like really get a grasp on any of this stuff. And what I've learned, again, it's that 10,000 hours of doing science. If you just apply yourself and keep focused on little specific things, you can actually make accomplishments and get things done.
And it's a small price to pay in that grander scheme of things that you just talked about. As soon as you put it in the trillion year perspective, what's 10,000 hours?
Yeah.
So where do you go from here, Don? What's next for you? What are your interests, both in your paycheck life, but probably more importantly for what we're talking about, where do you want to go with this exploration of yoga and consciousness?
Well, let's see, with respect to the paycheck life, we maybe should do another talk about that, because it's very, very interesting where that's going. And that actually, you mentioned at the very beginning about the nonlinear dynamics work that I'm doing. And believe it or not, that was completely conditioned by learning all these Eastern ideas, right? It's this idea that everything is dynamical patterns that you learn from studying yoga. So if that's true, well, you know, I study cell death, right? So why can't cell death be a dynamical pattern too, right? So the connection, the very thought of that came from studying these Indian ideas. And so that's all very interesting. I'm very excited about that. And I don't want to go off on it too much. With regard to this other stuff, I don't know. It's just always, I kind of am like Brownian motion. I don't have any direction. I've never really had any direction. I mean, as I learn the yoga ideas, they exert an influence. They're kind of like acid in a way. They like corrode away all the crap, you know? And so there is these basic ideas in yoga called yama and niyama. And they're like the, you know, the very, very, like I compare it in the book to reading and writing, right? You can't do science unless you know how to read and write. Mm-hmm. And you can't do yoga unless you do yama and niyama.
Yep.
And so if anybody asks me, do you practice yoga? I can say yes, because I just practice yama and niyama.
And go over really just quickly what those are, because again, as you allude to, most of us spend our life just trying to aspire to some of the basics there of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the idea, like I say in the book, it's kind of like the Ten Commandments, but you know, you don't do it because you're going to go to hell. You do it because it's the logical necessity to move on to the deeper stages. And it's basically the idea of getting rid of all the unnecessary stuff in your mind that would block you from progressing further into yoga and developing those habits that will allow you to deal with things as they arise later on, even as you go into more advanced stages. So both yama and niyama have several different aspects, like with, for example, yama, you're like supposed to tell the truth.
Truthfulness, right?
Yeah, not harm things. Abstinence is one of them, which a lot of people in the West don't want to hear. But, you know, the one of the things way back early on when I was in college, when I first got exposed to the ideas of Raja Yoga and Patanjali's yoga, was about just this one about truthfulness. Because the book I was reading made the point, how can you know what is truth if you can't tell the truth? And that has always stuck with me just unbelievably. And it to this day is like a guiding light in my thinking. And it's not just like telling the truth to somebody else where you might have a lie that you're covering up something bad you did. It's not that. It's like telling the truth to yourself about deep issues, right? Am I delusional? When I believe these things, why do I believe X? Does it make me feel good? Does it make me feel more important than somebody else? You know what I'm saying? It's like that level of truth with yourself.
And it goes hand in hand with seeking the truth, which is kind of a hard thing, but we all intuitively know when we're pushing back our own nonsense and seeking a deeper truth. I think that's part of it.
Right. And so, you know, these are the kind of things that I find as I read this stuff, it's just very natural that, you know, it makes you think and reflect on these things and go, oh man, wow, I'm kind of stupid. You know, I need to like clean up these different parts. You know, you're right. This whole idea of like trying to become enlightened and be infinite and all that stuff, it makes no sense. Go drop acid and spend a night doing it. You're not going to want to do it all the time. That's not the point. You know, there's, and even one of the core ideas in the Yoga Sutras is that that would never come to pass anyways unless you clean up your karma, like what you alluded to, right? After this life, we make all these reverberations in the universe. It brings us back. We keep recycling in our lives until that stuff cleans up anyway, right? And if there's some greater purpose to it or whatever, you know, I don't know. But again, this idea of karma, I mean, that Newton identified karma, right? Mm-hmm. That's Newton's third law. For every action, there's a reaction. Mm-hmm. So it happens in the most grossest forms of physical matter, and it happens all the way up through the psychological and spiritual levels that we exist at. And, you know, those are kind of the practical things that I focus on now.
Take a minute and tell people what they're going to find if they go to your excellent website, dondeg.com.
All my ramblings. I just put everything up. You know, again, this kind of comes back to the early influence of yoga. I mean, somehow my karma is such that the stuff I do for my paycheck, I'm more than satisfied with that. And so all this other stuff that I do, it's just give it back to the world, right? The world gave to me, I give back to the world. That's kind of how I look at this. So, you know, early on where my ego drove me a little bit, I tried to sell some of my material. And let's see, I was called arrogant. Other people didn't understand what I was talking about. So I was just like, screw this. And then, boom, there was the internet, and I started making friends and finding other people with these common interests. And, you know, I'm all for this spirit of just giving the information away. It's kind of like a Johnny Appleseed mentality.
Well, it's really quite an amazing body of work, and we'll obviously have links to a lot of this stuff in the show notes. But I do encourage everyone to go to the website, check it out. You'll find something there that'll strain your brain in one way or another. It's just been great having you on the phone. Again, our guest has been Dr. Donald DeGracia from Wayne State University School of Medicine and from DONDEG.com. Don, thanks again so much for joining me.
Yeah, this was great, Alex. I really appreciate it, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thanks again to Dr. DeGracia for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess I'd have one question to tee up from this interview. What should we make of science that is outside of Western science? I think one of Don's points that was really fascinating is that when he looks at the yogic tradition and yogic philosophy, he's not looking at it through a spiritual lens, but I get the sense that he's looking at it from a scientific lens and saying, gee, have these folks discovered something in a different way that we need to pay attention to? And I think that's such a blind spot for us in the West that I'd like to tee that up as a question. And that is, do other cultures offer a science in the way that we think about science, a science that deserves our attention? So that's the question. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can leave a message right there in the comment section, jump over to the forum, or send me an email. You can always send me an email, Facebook. Not always super prompt on getting to those, depending on what's going on, but I do try and eventually get to all of them. So if that's the way you want to communicate with me, that's fine as well. I have a number of interesting shows coming up. I have already recorded a bunch of shows. I'm just in the process of getting those out. I'm trying to stick to my every other week schedule, but I might have to increase that to get a couple of additional little shows that I want to get out here, but we'll see how all that comes. Now that I've wrapped up my book, I've been able to dive back into the forum and some of the comments on the website, and I'm reminded of how much I enjoy connecting with you, the folks who listen to this show and are going through this Skeptico adventure with me. You're always in my thoughts, and I love hearing from you and connecting with you. It's one of the great gifts of this thing we call the internet, that I can connect with people that I don't know, and then I can actually get to know them. And there's so many of you who I now consider friends in the very real sense of the word. So that's a nice thing. And I certainly hope that if you do feel a desire to reach out and connect with me, please do. And I'll try my best to reach back. So then that's going to do it for this episode. Do take care, and bye for now.